to turn down. Would stretch from London to New York town. The upper crust I visit, but say, what is it with you? Oh, tell me why. Am I no kick to you? I, who'd always stick to you, fly through thin and thick to you. Tell me why I taboo those beauty columns. Ask my advice, though I was Miss America twice. Still, you got me outsmarted.
And we're back.
And we're back with the window. It is April. My phone keeps on going in and out. Hope everybody heard that. It's April 1st, and it is the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. We are back, bringing you another edition of our weekly adventure into the news about Linux and open source. We're hoping that there won't be too many April Fool's stories that we're going to be pulling people's chains on, but and we'll stick to the news as best we can. But we'd like to thank everybody for showing up and listening to the show. We had a little, not a technical problem, but an administrative problem of getting things posted out this afternoon. A lot of the postings didn't actually hit the internet till 6:30 or 7 o'clock this evening, so we're probably going to have more people listening to the show on rerun than we will listening to it live. But whatever. Glad you could make it. We are here with most of the rest of the crew. We are expecting Doc to call in at any time. Doc is at a conference, and when he calls in, we're going to let him sneak right through because he's only going to have about a five-minute window of opportunity to join us. It just worked out that he is doing a presentation right during the middle of the show tonight, so hopefully we'll sneak him in here a little later on this afternoon. But the rest of the crew is here. We'll start on the opposite end from what we normally do. How are you doing tonight, Russ?
Oh, hanging in.
What's the word on the street in Washington, D.C.? Are things starting to loosen up? The community becoming a little less nervous now that people are starting to get used to war? Not that you can get used to war, but are things getting back to normal?
I don't know if anything ever gets back to normal around here, things are going on. I don't sense that anyone's cowering in their chairs waiting for the next thing to occur. And quite frankly, after we went through the business of that Beltway sniper pair that we gotten last year, I don't think anyone gets really nervous anymore.
Yeah, that was a real gut check awakening for the entire community, I'm quite sure.
Yeah, because that was a lot more than political positions and what have you. When bullets are whistling past your ear.
I suppose it's amazing what a sniper or two will do to a rush hour, huh?
So, that's about it.
On the other end, what is it? Are any midterms by now?
Oh yeah, we're going to have quarter grades go out here next week, so we're about there. Yeah, 9 more weeks for the semester.
Yep. Oh yeah.
I have a friend who's having an interesting time of it. He's running Windows XP on his laptop, and I'm helping him out with things. He's wants to be a Linux person. He's a student. He's going to go into physics and hoping to get into Berkeley. You know, we wish him luck. He's very intelligent, but I've got him growing on connecting here. He visits here, and he'll connect to my network, and I've got him fixed up with PuTTY, which is the Windows version of SSH, which works really cool. It's a free program. And also, he's apparently has gone ahead and unloaded Cygwin on, which will hopefully allow him to run X-Free on Windows XP, and I'll probably report on that in the next week or so. yeah, well, as soon as we can get together on that.
That'll be cool. Looking forward to it. We're going to go ahead and break in. Doc, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, hi, Doc.
Doc.
Hi.
We're going to let you sneak in, Doc, because we know you're very, very limited on time.
Yeah. I'm walking from one appointment to another in downtown, in sunny, beautiful, used to be raining downtown San Jose, where I arrived this morning just before they started quarantining planes.
Wow.
I don't know if you heard about that, but they've got a thing happening where an American Airlines plane was held there for something to do with this Asian disease that's going around.
Oh, yeah.
With SARS.
SARS. Yeah, a partial, you add a few more and you've got my name. A few more letters right there. Anyway, I just came from a panel on decentralization, and it was interesting the theme that I was bringing up on it. I've been working for 4 months on a big piece for Linux Journal that'll be out in July, but the interesting exercise with it has been to look at the enterprise from the inside rather than from the outside. In other words, almost everything you see in the mainstream press takes a look at the enterprise from what can a vendor sell into this. And if you go look at it from the other angle, from not in an anti-vendor way, but in a where the vendor is an option way, there's a huge amount of stuff going on. It's extremely independent and raises the suspicion on my part what we've been operating on for a long time is what we might call the great vendor theory of computing. And we're coming to the end of that. And Linux is a big part of that, but LAMP is a big part of that, too. An awful lot of guys are working on LAMP applications. LAMP is sort of like any enterprise turning into kind of a hot term lately. You guys familiar with LAMP? I assume you are.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Linux, Apache, MySQL, Perl, Python, PHP,
yeah.
and so forth. So it's been kind of an interesting exercise. We talked about this on the panel here, that part of the decentralization that's going on in the world is a centralization of competence inside corporations around the need simply to get stuff done, and outside the traditional power relationships where companies do what vendors want them to do. So that's sort of, there's no real news attached to that, except that I've been sort of obsessing on it for the last few months, so it's all I can talk about.
Well, that's something good.
And if any listeners, by the way, want to get any last... it's amazing how many people don't want to talk about it, though. I mean, it's like... there are a few companies like General Dynamics or Morgan Stanley that are out there saying Linux forever and we're just turning this whole thing around, but there are a lot of others with very familiar names where the rank and file are saying that we're completely changing the company and we're making the company smarter from the inside out, but we're not allowed to say that. So if anybody wants to write to me and tell me more about that, need of a few more cool quotes, so I'm trolling for quotes here.
I'll see if I can find you some, because very recently we have started to get some grumblings or rumblings, I suppose is the better word for it, here in Chicago, that all of a sudden having the magic four letters MCSE attached to your
initials
is no longer a big deal right now.
Right, it's like being a Novell certified engineer now.
Right, exactly. The MCSC certification is really becoming passe. Enterprise people are starting to look for Linux and Unix people, and colleges that had been dragging their feet at preparing programs are in a mad dash to get programs launched. In fact, here in the Chicago suburbs, one of the better-known junior colleges in the United States, College of DuPage, just this past couple of weeks ago, started up a new quarter, and every single Linux class they offered got filled.
Yep. 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 It's a new standard. It's just, you know, I mean, it's like, I mean, there's so many aspects to it. I mean, the Boeing, for example, got a huge part of the future combat, I think it's FCS or something. It's a 10-year program. And the first thing they just said right out of the gate is, well, we're going to build this on Linux because, you know, we know where Linux is going to be over the next 10 years. Or at least if we don't know, we can, you know, stay abreast of it. But there's no way we can tell where anything, you know, somebody owns is going to be at.
What I think is important about this college thing, though, Doc, is that colleges do, you know, they point the direction in the far long-term development path, what's going to be happening, like, 10 years out in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, and Arnie can feel free to jump in on this, but historically, academia is really slow to make a move.
They're pretty well, you know, there's a lot of academia still running on old Microsoft. I'm Microsoft, old Apple Macintosh.
Absolutely. And so for all of a sudden this becoming an important issue with academia, really at the same time as the big enterprise players are starting to take notice of it, this really is a real wholesale major shift in the way we've been looking at the market in terms of the development market of where people are going to be putting assets in future development.
Jeff, as far as academia is concerned, there's a great big huge divide between the CIS programs and the consumer science computer science programs. The computer science programs are the ones doing the Linux stuff and the cutting edge stuff, but the CIS programs are almost all locked right into Windows and I mean exclusively.
Yeah, and they will continue to be so for many years, honey.
You know, I have no doubt. But, you know, I mean, as far as, you know, web services and stuff is what they're teaching and, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's the latest hot thing. And CIS just, you know, is going to be behind this computer science, rather.
Yeah, you know, an interesting thing, just you mentioned web services that I got from Jamie Lewis, who's with the Burton Group. He was at PC Forum as well. And, in fact, he wrote a very interesting piece called, you know, David Weinberg and I wrote a thing called World of Ends, which is kind of like another clue train, which is at worldofends.com and .org and other things. But and he wrote World of Means, which is about what's happening in the enterprise. But one of the things he said is that there's sort of like BS web services, which is a lot of the stuff Microsoft's talking about, and IBM is as well, that's very theoretical and very much about you know, more things for big vendors to sell to big companies. And then there's this ad hoc kind that's all about data talking to data. And they're using XML and SOAP and XML RPC and standards like that that have been developed mostly by small guys, just looking for ways, in his term, that any two companies or any two parts of companies can communicate with each other using plain data without having to replicate the other party's DNA in order to understand what's going on. It's very interesting. It's that the whole web services thing, very much like other conversations, is going to be taken over by the rank and file, simply finding ways to do stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So a route around proprietary. So, Doc, do you have any more interesting stories out of the San Jose market for us?
Nothing is just, you know, jumping out at me right now. It's just that I sense just in the last, you know, we're not at what Eric Raymond called GandhiCon 4 yet, you know, which is the then we win stage. But I really sense a movement in that direction. Avery Leifert of Linux Care had a pretty good line about things at PC Forum. He said, In most enterprises, Linux is utterly done. I mean, Linux is not even an issue anymore. I mean, it's utterly approved. It's, you know, there are a few pockets of opposition, but for the most part, it's one. But open source still has a way to go as an idea that has to sell upstream, even though it's quite obvious to the people putting it to work that open source code has more intrinsic value than closed source code does, all other things being equal. And so that was just sort of an interesting thing that, you know, his estimate on it is that there really isn't an argument about Linux anymore. It's moved on to other things. So it's sort of like Linux is at GandhiCon 4, but open source is more like at GandhiCon 3.
Okay.
So, and I see my next date waving at me, so I'll relieve you guys of the sounds of trolleys going by in the background.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon, Dad.
Okay, see you guys.
Bye, Dad.
Okay, Russ, do you have any hot stories really for us?
Yeah, got a few shorties here. One that was making the rounds a little bit earlier in the week has to do with Linux of viruses, and we actually touched on this a few weeks ago. Central Command has been apparently added again, issuing statements about the fact that Linux is highly vulnerable to viruses and you need their software. And if you follow the link from the webpage, you'll notice that there are some people who actually take issue with that. And I definitely would be among those that would take issue with it. There's a lot that has to happen for Linux to be subjected to the types of viruses that we find inside the Windows world. Not to say that it's free of worms and other compromises, but for crying out loud, the type of stuff that we find being handled by antivirus programs just aren't going to be an issue for a while. Not until people make suitably stupid mail handlers, and so far I haven't seen that occur. So,
plus the fact that not only does you have to have a stupid mail handler, you have to have a stupid administrator that runs the mail handler as root, and
yeah,
that's not going to happen either.
Yeah, or users, you know, using some sort of client software that automatically executes attachments without
yeah, but even then, it's got to have you're in client space and client privileges instead of root privileges.
Right.
So you're not going to damage the system. Maybe you'll damage your own files.
Exactly. It doesn't have the same potential.
The security model of Linux and Unix in general is just entirely different than what Microsoft is doing.
Right. So, I mean, you can expect to see more of that going on, and quite frankly, it amazes me, but a lot of people coming, especially businesses coming from the Microsoft world, are asking, well, where's your virus protection? And so that's kind of an uphill battle right now to try to explain these things. So I expect that we'll see a lot more articles like this coming up in the near future.
I actually think, ironically, at least in the short term, you're going to meet with less resistance if you just go ahead and put on some kind of a server-side virus tool, even if it ends up costing a couple hundred bucks. I think the couple hundred bucks spent is probably well spent if it gets people by the fear and doubt issue.
Yeah,
you do it once, you don't have to do it again.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I don't have an issue with the fact that there are companies creating a product for that space because, yeah, just like you said, there are going to be organizations that are going to want the tool even if it's not really doing anything. But it does irk me when I see the organizations making the tools making claims that are really, really hard to substantiate. So...
Yes. There's a difference in the perception whether they are saying, "Well, go ahead and buy our software because it's a good safety measure just in case," or "Buy our software because if you don't, you're a fool because Linux doesn't work." Completely different way of coming about doing it.
Yeah.
But I know a couple of them out there are not. Being real honest about this, but most of the Linux virus software that I have seen has not taken too strong of an approach. I'm going to have to get you a list of the names of some of the ones I've looked at, because the story really has piqued my interest. I was doing a bunch of looking around before the show today. So, but any more stories?
Yeah, there's an interesting one. Once again, the link appears on our webpage about how five TV makers are preparing the specs for new internet TV devices. And interestingly enough, they're going to be doing it built on Linux, and they intend, according to the article, to publish any changes through the GPL, just like any good citizen of the open source community might. So that's an interesting move, and it's good to see that Linux in the home is coming in different forms, not just the question of the desktop computing like Windows is doing, but more back into the area where TiVo and others have gone, where it's part of a home-based device.
Yeah, they've been talking about the standard for quite some time. I'm glad that they're actually getting somewhere with actually. Do you happen to have is the URL on the website?
Yeah, URL's on the website.
Good.
Find the link there. It's a story in the EE Times that is discussing it. There's a note over at
Hang on a second. Before you move on with that,
okay.
I'm going to come back to you. But it sort of brings to mind a story that I want to bring up, that I really wanted to bring up while Doc was on. But it's sort of a related story. I'm not going to go into too much depth of it tonight, but we talked about the story about 3 weeks ago when the FCC ruled about the new national regulations. These are, of course, not laws. They're regulations put down by the FCC, but new interpretations of the 1996 Telecommunications Act is going to have new rules that lean way, 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 way in favor of any incumbent exchange carrier, be it a phone company or a cable TV company. And so these access devices, of course, are going to be there to enhance the ability of these incumbent local exchange carriers, be they phone companies or cable TV companies, to provide broadband service to the masses. The relevance of why I'm bringing this story up again, why I'm mentioning it after we talked about it 3 weeks ago, is because this ruling has now dropped down to the local level, and it is now about to enter the state public utility boards and public utility agencies. And so I want everybody who is listening, we've got a real important announcement that we're going to be making in about 48 hours in support of an action that is being taken to combat this new regulatory process that is literally in danger of stealing the Internet away and handing it to five phone companies and four cable companies. So anybody who's listening to the show, be it live or picking this show up later, please go to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com. Please tell your friends to go to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, and at least temporarily, at least for the next week, subscribe to our mailing list, because there's going to be an announcement coming out of GeekPack of a major funding effort and a major target. The target is going to be SBC, Southwestern Bell Company. And we're going to be launching a lobbying effort against SBC in a couple of Midwestern states. I've been in contact with a number of directors of national ISP associations, and we're working on details of a press release right now. That's why we don't have it ready right now, for some co-sponsoring of this effort. there will be PayPal links up in about 48 hours. And so join our mailing list so you can get word of it right away, and we're going to go after the bad guys. And we need people out there to spread the word, because we need to, you know, hey, $5 from everybody who visits Slashdot over a month will give us enough money to run a campaign against SPC for a year. So hopefully this will work on the grassroots level. So let me get back to you, Russ, now. Come back, and what's your next story of the week?
Yeah, there's a piece over at eWeek, and once again the link's on the on our main page, called Sun Drops Its Linux Distribution by Peter Galley. And this, to me, was a very interesting story for a couple of reasons. One is that Sun, being one of the old-time Unix vendors, has finally, apparently, come to the realization that the rules that apply to Unix don't necessarily apply to Linux. And in particular, it's not necessarily a good thing to have your own distribution. It costs money in a lot of ways. It requires some reputation and other things to be built up around it. And Sun, I think, has figured out that it's probably better just to support one of the existing distributions rather than, or in their case, I believe, multiple existing distributions, according to what they're saying, rather than having your own. And this is something that a number of the larger players have had to deal with over time, and it's kind of good to see that Sun is learning, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Well, that's good. Put more money into the pockets of Red Hat, SUSE, and Mandrake, that's for sure.
That's it. And don't try to play the Linux game with the old Unix rules, because when it came down to it, the old Unix rules had a lot to do with the fact that Unix fell out of favor and never grew past where it could have, past where it did grow. So it's good to learn. It's good to get on board new things. And my final piece for the week is actually a press release from the Free Software Foundation. Now, this is not the alleged press release that you may have seen over at NewsForge and Slashdot, where the FSF decided to start a shared source program after Microsoft became the major investor in the FSF. That was a very interesting piece by Robin Miller, and I'm sure he was drinking some really good scotch when he put that one together. But this has to do with FSF announcing a corporate patronage program, and once again, this is kind of interesting because the whole reason for the open source term in the first place was to try to make things more available to corporations. Now it appears that FSF is doing their own deal around that, trying to get corporations to sign on and help them with their work. And so this is an interesting interesting event from that respect.
Yeah, it is very interesting. All right. Kevin, you got any new product releases this week?
Red Hat 9 is out for people who have put up the money to get it early. Everybody else is going to be getting it next Monday, so hopefully we'll be able to grab it early and do an install and get some reviews. There's already a couple of reviews been posted, and it sounds pretty promising. Sounds like the binary incompatibility issues that people were afraid of aren't such a big deal after all.
So it's not breaking right and left?
A few things, but not as many things as I was expecting to see.
Okay.
So we'll see once I get to actually play with it.
Yeah, don't convert the stream servers yet, that's for sure. We've had enough technical issues the last month.
Maybe. Oh, yeah.
Is that the only release?
Yeah, that's it. I was just wondering if anybody saw any good April Fool's sites so far. apart from the Gentoo announcement that they're switching to RPM. And Fresh Meat's job posting, of course.
Anybody see the Tom's Hardware piece?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I saw that one earlier.
I like the white space programming language. That was a good one.
I saw
look real enough that I might even delve into that site a little deeper to see if there's really anything there.
Well, I'm talking about Microsoft Buys Linux.
Oh yeah, that one happens every April.
That's every year. In an unrelated industry, on one of the Fox websites this morning, there was a rumor being spread. I'm not sure by who. I think it was one of the producers of Sean Hannity, one of the people at Fox. They were spreading a rumor around that Peter Arnett had been hired by Fox, which is sort of laughable. If you know Fox, there's no way that they would ever hire Peter Arnett. But
not for the job he's used to doing, anyway.
Yeah, not for $275,000 a year. That's for damn sure. But that's another story altogether. Other than that, this year has been, you know, sort of calm in terms of the usual plethora of April Fool's stuff that comes out. So I haven't had anything good. Arnie, you got any good stories of the week?
Oh yeah, I got some good ones. Let's see, which one shall I start with? Well, it's the Oracle Linux deal. Oracle is dedicating $150 million to support third-party development efforts targeting Linux applications for Oracle. And apparently Larry Ellison is back in his mode of full court press of open source free software, and that's good for us. So too bad he doesn't take, you know, with all the money he has, he doesn't invest $1 billion just like IBM does. But that was from a CRN. I have a really sad story right now. Adam Osborne died last week. And,
oh, wow.
And those of you who know Adam Osborne, I effectively learned microcomputers with his books, which were... He released three or four different books entitled The Introduction to Microprocessors. And this was a hardware-oriented and also software-oriented book on teaching exactly how the technology works at the bit level and at the hardware level. The volume two of the thing got really deeply into bit slice projects, which is basically build your own CPU. Without Adam Osborne, there would just be a lot of geeks around here who wouldn't understand the technology, wouldn't have understood the technology. His books were absolutely wonderful, very easy to read and extremely informative. And many people know Osborne by his Osborne computer, which was the first arguably portable computer, but also a marketing failure. After two or three years, the company went bankrupt. I know a lot of people had the Osborne computer, and it was a decent little thing. It was a 5-inch screen. It wasn't real whippy. It ran CPM. And they had a lot of trouble with keeping its reliability up. But I know a lot of people had them, and they were quite reliable. Adam Osborne was 64. He survived by three daughters and two divorced wives,
yeah.
And he's the industry will definitely miss him.
Absolutely. For those of us who were in the trenches back in the early days when it was Radio Shack versus Apple versus Commodore versus Osborne.
Well, I mean, Osborne published his books in 1974. And that was before Apple, before...
Yeah, but his computer company really got going back in 79.
1981.
Yeah, but I believe he started the company in 79. He may not have had product until 80, 81.
Yeah.
But, no, I remember people at Radio Shack in 79 going to work for him, we lost people to Osborne when I was working at Radio Shack in 79.
Yeah.
Writing software for the Model 1.
That was an incredible little machine. I mean, it ran reliably. You got a good one. It ran reliable.
And you know what? So the Osborne was a great little computer if you never moved it.
Yes.
We called it forkliftable. but you know, it was a great little computer. And you know, back then CPM, man, that was a monster operating system. It was very powerful. Made spreadsheets possible.
Yep.
It really solved the floating point error that had been bugging big systems for years and years and years. So.
And that was running on an 8080 or a Z80 processor,
yep.
Which was an 8-bit. The Z80 became the de facto standard and everything. But, you know, Adam, when you lose a person like Adam Osborne, that you've lost someone very important, and he was only 64 years old. I have another couple of stories here. Gartner is saying... that Linux accounted for 9% of the 4.6 million server operating system licenses shipped last year, up from 6.5% the year before. And they're accounting for that Red Hat and SUSE are the distributions that partially are responsible for that. Of course, we know that measurement is probably not real accurate. Windows still dominates with nearly 70% of the market. And, of course, we probably know that's probably too high. But how do you measure it? a third one, and this one is going to link, is my Clueless Pundit of the Week. Many of you have heard of Tony Stanko, who was the founded Free Developer Net website. An associated director of the Cybersecurity Policy and Research Institute of George Washington University, as a very strong free software advocate, and I've been on his mailing list for quite some time, and always enjoy his sage words and stuff. He has founded a new, let's see what to call it, a new open source software firm called eGovOS, eGovOS, and the website is www.egovos.org, and this is a very interesting take, and he's got a very interesting business model. What he's trying to do is get people to develop open source software from the perspective of being closed source. So what he's got is he sets up an escrow account managed by eGovOS, and sets the software developer sets a sales threshold. Sales of all buyers would accumulate, and once the threshold is met, the source code is opened and licensed under GPL to all takers. Now, here's where we get the Clueless Pundit of the Week. John Meyer, senior analyst at Forrester Research, one of my favorites, called the plan, quote, bizarre. All right, I'm going to read his quote. This is one of those wonderful, wonderful quotes of, "It makes no sense, and it's anti-capitalism, because what a company risks when they open source their code is that somebody else is going to modify it enough to claim it as their own intellectual property and have a competing product. It's also a way to have competitors scratch someone out of the market, because they're going to review what you have and figure out a way to do it better." John Meyer, I hope you enjoy all the email you get from the Linux Show listeners, because they're going to get some. This guy is the Clueless Pundit of the Week.
Okay, in reference to the Clueless Pundit of the Week, when they are an analyst,
yeah,
you would prefer that, to keep things in proper context, you call them analysts.
Analyst.
Any more stories, Arnie, before we move on?
Well, let's see. There's a...
We are running close.
A Legato's Networker 702 support Linux. This is a backup backup, a very, very robust backup program, and they're releasing a Linux version, and that's about it. That's all I have this week.
Okay, we'll take a short break and come back with segment number two of the Linux Show for April 1st, 2003. We are not joking around here tonight. We're giving the straight news, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Everybody hang in there.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy, but when I do, I don't follow through, cause my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a guy tonight to dine out to Fison and Hattie, I do suit your, he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to daddy. Simply could it be bad? And my heart belongs to daddy. Dad, 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 dad. Want to warn you, daddy, so I think you're perfectly swell. My heart belongs to daddy, cause my daddy, he treats it so well.
And we're back.
It's segment number two of the Linux Show for April 1st, 2003. This is no April Fool's joke. In fact, it's a very, very serious subject we're going to be covering on segment number two. Great guest tonight. For those of you out there who have been asking us for another really meaty guest with a real important story tonight's night. Got a great follow-up on a news story that we've been covering literally for weeks. Article came out, when was it, Russ? 2-3 weeks ago, or maybe we should just ask Nick. He knows when.
March 14th, was it?
March 14th, yeah. Debunking the Linux / Windows market share myth by Nick Petrelli. And Nick has, of course, been on the Linux Show before. He's a well-known, expert, pundit, whatever term you want to talk about in terms of open source and Linux marketplace, and is an extremely well-received article that I have already been using. I've already been quoting myself as evidence and support information within my own classrooms at at the college I teach at. So with no further ado, Nick, welcome back to the Linux Show.
And, my pleasure to be here. Although I resemble that meaty comment.
Well, intellectually meaty.
Thanks. Anyway, so what have you been telling your college students?
Well, I have been on a one man campaign within the college that I teach at to get them to start offering a Linux program now for 4 years. You know, here I am, a teacher at their college. What better asset could you have?
Wow, yeah.
Than to start a Linux program. But there is so much fear and doubt within academia to do anything adventurous that, most colleges and universities are, you know, right now offering lots and lots of classes like, you know, web development using HTML.
But that makes it really odd, because that's really where you find such a huge portion of the Linux installed base. I mean, you know, or even if it's not Linux, you know, certainly Apache, and that's running on Unix mostly. One form of flavor of Unix, or not whether it's Linux or Solaris or whatever. So you'd think that'd be a real easy sell to a college, because they got a.
It is. And academia is always real slow to act on most things, and. Very recently, it's really started to turn around. I was talking at the very beginning of the show. In particular, we've got an experience here in the Chicago area where one of the junior colleges, a college by the name of College of DuPage, and I want to give them their kudos for having the foresight to really go full bore in terms of really researching Linux program from end to end. And this is an LPI-based certification program that has a track that includes four different classes right now, and they're adding classes. And they have filled enormous numbers of sessions because they are following closely the enterprise buzz, and the enterprise buzz right now is the future in development is in Linux. It's not in Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And College of DuPage is definitely there. My college is a little slower, and hopefully I will have them turn around. But Nick, why don't you fill in the people who are out there on the IRC and people who are listening on the process that you went through to gather the information up about these remarkable numbers that are development oriented.
Okay, this was an Evans data survey. They asked me on the record. I don't know if you know Esther Schindler. She's an analyst and author that I've known since the OS2 days. Anyway, she hooked me up with Evans. Evans has been doing Linux surveys now for a few years, and I worked with them on this one. Basically, you know, help them refine the survey itself. If I had it to do it all over again, I can see now what I would have asked more questions and some different questions or suggested different questions. It's one of the occupational hazards of doing this kind of stuff, because you see the answers and you say, well, gosh, you know, if I'd only asked this question, I would have gotten so much more information. But in any case, they sent the survey to about 400 developers who develop at least part of their time on Linux, and that could be just about anything. Even 1% of their attention goes to Linux development. But they had to be doing some sort of Linux development, because the survey was meant to discover the needs, the desires, the trends, and so on among people who use Linux at least part of the time. And one of the interesting things that I noticed in the survey was that whereas 50% of these developers spend most of their time developing for Windows, and about 40% of them spend most of their time developing for Linux. Those figures are going to reverse next year. The 50% will be spending most of their time on Linux, and 40% most of the time on Windows. And the other interesting thing was that among people who use Linux as their primary development platform, the vast majority of them used to use Windows. Of some you know, version of Windows. Far fewer are used to use Unix, which goes contrary to what you've been reading and what you'll have most people have been reading in most of the mainstream press, and that is that Linux steals more market share from Unix than it does from Windows. That doesn't make sense. That never made sense to me to begin with. I mean, if Windows has so much market share, then it seems only logical that Linux is going to take market share from anything. It's going to take it from the one that has the most market share. Of course, this was server-side development primarily, and Windows does not dominate on the server, so you'd expect even more to see, you know, if it is true that Linux robs from Unix more than it does from Windows, you'd expect it to see it in these numbers. And you don't. You see, more Windows developers are moving to Linux than Unix developers moving to Linux. So there's clearly, you know, there's a shift going on that even Microsoft is beginning to acknowledge, because they basically have no choice at this point. And what you were talking about web applications, most of these people are doing web applications, as a matter of fact. Again, you can see that directly from the data, because you can see the target clients are virtually anything, which means that the applications that they're building are primarily browser-based. But the type of applications ranges from everything from 64-bit commercial applications. Believe it or not, they're in there. In fact, they take a significant portion of what they're doing is on some of the 64-bit platforms and commercials, like, you know, to sell them to internal IT corporate applications. There's a lot of work going on in Linux that doesn't get nearly as much attention as it should.
How did they come up with this list of developers, by the way? What was the methodology for locating them?
I may have this wrong because I may have some details wrong because I was not in on part of this part of the process. But from what I understand, they solicited developers on the internet in order to apply for it, and then out of those they selected 400 of the developers and qualified them. Basically, you know, went through an application process to make sure that they fit the kind of profile that they need for that kind of survey. In other words, it sounds like it's self-selecting, but it's not. The first step is self-selecting, and after that, they go through a qualification process.
And is there anything that you're able to extrapolate out of these numbers in terms of, okay, these developers are, okay, their own development tools are shifting over. The amount of time that they're doing development is shifting over. Is there any kind of number that your study can really legitimately extrapolate out in terms of critical mass of application development, where a 50 percentile number may be reached in the relative near future, where developers are actually spending half or more of the resources developing developing Linux applications than Windows applications.
The trend that they say is that by next year that 50% of the developers that were surveyed will be spending the majority of their time focused on Linux.
But that's of surveyed.
Yeah.
Is there any way you can extrapolate that out over?
No, I don't see how you could do that. And I'm not sure you'd even want that number because a lot of those numbers, in my opinion anyway, are totally meaningless. One of the things I pointed out in the article and elsewhere is that it gets to be, the numbers game is not only deceiving, but it, sometimes it's deceiving in some of the nastiest ways. It's like, you read, I guess I'd love to, I wish I could point out the URL, but there have been a rash of case studies published lately where people are moving from Windows to Linux at the server, and they're cutting back an enormous number of machines because they're finding that, you know, far fewer machines running Linux can handle the same load that they were that they had to use far more Windows servers to handle. So how do you really represent that in terms of numbers? Because I'm going to make up some numbers here just for as the example. If you've got 50 servers, 50 Windows servers in Company A, and you've got 10 Linux servers in Company B, and both of them are serving the same purpose and the same load, then in market share figures, it sure sounds to me like Windows is beating Linux because, you know, they've got a lot more servers out there in the market share than Linux. But you're measuring the wrong thing. You're measuring physical copies that are necessary, and Windows wins because it's inferior, which is really strange. I prefer not to get caught up in those kinds of measurements, and I really don't think that you could extrapolate that kind of prediction out of this kind of survey anyway.
Okay, well let me push it to you in a different direction then.
Couple of interesting things if you really want to speculate. And again, this is pure speculation.
And I want to speculate.
Well, here's a speculation for you. That is, remember, you've got 50% of these developers are currently focusing primarily on Windows. Okay, so we're not talking about Linux. We're not talking about 400 Linux fanatics who were surveyed, because they obviously wouldn't. If they had their druthers, they wouldn't be working on Windows at this point. And they're using things like .NET and so on, but that's the key. 17% of them are using .NET, whereas a much larger percentage, I don't have the exact number for me, I think it was 60% or something, are using things like IBM WebSphere and Java and so on. Sun 1, something like 32% are actually using Sun 1. And yet 50% of them said that if Mono or .gnu, which are the open source clones of .NET, if they're successful, they will go with them. They'll actually use them. I mean, you know, those kinds of things, that's a throwaway number in a sense, because it remains to be seen if it's successful, and even if it is successful, whether or not these people will actually go with them, because maybe they won't like what they see when it becomes successful. But you can see they don't have a philosophical problem with .NET as a platform. Otherwise, they wouldn't say they would go with .NU or Mono. And yet, when it comes down to making the decision, only 70% are actually using .NET, and it's here today. So, in other words, it seems to me that Microsoft is losing. It's not accomplishing with .NET what it intended to accomplish, and that is to win back the developer base. And hook them into the Windows platform. So if you want to extrapolate that out to the future, it seems to me that one of the biggest ventures that Microsoft or efforts that Microsoft is making to take over the world in the future is not working out the way they planned.
That's interesting, because and again, this is very very anecdotal, because I'm just taking a handful of colleges that are in my area that do have what I would consider higher level development programs, not just MCSE mills, but I mean legitimate colleges teaching development. All but one of those colleges at the moment. With the exception being that College of DuPage that I mentioned before, are really focusing their curriculum on .NET.
That's interesting. Since .NET is like, you know, it's everything from breath mints to
it is
web services. What is it they're focusing on? Visual Studio or
primarily the Studio.
Yeah, you see, that's not really .NET. I mean, that's an IDE, and I can see why they would want to cover. I'm not saying it's a wise idea, but that seems it's a no-brainer to cover something like that.
Yes, I look at it that this is part of the ongoing fear and doubt strategy out of Microsoft, because they're telling the colleges, as well as the technical training schools, that if you want to offer programs and not get complaints a year from now, this is what you're going to teach.
Yeah.
Because it's safe. And that's all part of this development issue that we have to just take a look at when we're going to look at how the numbers may shift in the next couple of years.
Well, here's an interesting. Take a guess at what. Speaking of visual development environments, guess what the most popular visual development environment is among these developers.
Delphi.
Nope.
Not Emacs.
Nope.
I have no clue.
KDevelop.
Oh yeah, yeah, I heard that.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm not surprised. It's
far enough their favorite, and it's, you know, it's
slim, right, but it's nice.
Yes, it's very nice. It uses the K parts. You know, in other words, you can drop in component. It uses its own component structure. So it's a very nice development environment. It's very easy to use, but it surprised me because, you know, I didn't get a sense from the survey that these people are developing KDE programs. They just happen to really like this development environment.
Was there any particular statistic that sort of jumped out at you during this that you really didn't expect to see, but you came across?
Not really. The one thing that jumped out at me, which was immediately apparent, and it was so obvious once I saw it, but it wasn't something I gave that much thought to until I saw the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Was the numbers really demonstrate that the open source development software has two forces at work. One is that it is self-sufficient, and the other is that it's self-limiting. And if you think about this, it makes perfect sense. I mean, most open source software that exists to scratch an itch.
Mm-hmm.
So people build what they need as far as development tools are concerned. They build their own development tools to the specs that they need until they satisfy that itch, they scratch that itch. And then progress beyond that really slows down because, you know, once it does what you really need, you know, the rest of it's just icing on the cake.
Just a matter of how much effort you want to put into it to get the next features.
Yeah, if you don't want those, if the next features aren't what you really need to in order to develop your applications, then they get a lot less attention. They get attention, and they show up sooner or later. But you see where you really see this in the data is that the tools that are the most essential for building applications are the ones that developers are the most satisfied with. The tools that I feel are important, but they're not necessary for building applications, like code profilers, something that will help you, you know, improve the performance of your programs. Those are the ones that they're more boring to work on. They're not absolutely necessary for developing programs, so they don't get as much attention. And consequently, the developers are not nearly as happy with those kinds of tools for Linux.
Well, you know, the funny thing is about
across the board.
Nick, the funny thing about that is those type of tools, there are tons, because of the Unix heritage,
mm-hmm.
there are absolutely tons and tons of those tools available off the shelf from the legacy stuff.
Hmm.
And, you know, if you get a profile, hey, there's a simple GNU Tools Profiler does pretty good.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you don't need any, you know, if you're going to do it once, you don't do it once in a more than once in a while. You can use the legacy tools, and they work just beautifully.
Sure.
And that's the advantage of Linux and Unix in general, is because the tool set is complete and very robust. It might not be the most glamorous,
right,
but it gets the job done.
Yeah.
And for a software developer,
What more do you want?
Yeah, yeah. It's exactly, and you can see. I really think that that's revealing in a sense because it goes against why people are moving to things like VisualStudio.net and the whole .NET framework. Because Microsoft, I'm convinced that especially with respect to its language neutrality, you know, the common language interface, and Microsoft makes a big deal, and .NET fans tend to make a big deal about the fact that you can write in Visual Basic.NET and write in C# and combine these and stuff like that.
Wowie zowie.
To me, it's like a solution looking for a problem. It's I'm sorry, but I just don't hear, right, as of today, you can write in Ada, Python, and Java and compile it all to Java bytecode and combine it just the way you can, the same way you can do it with .NET. And I don't know, I think it would be, I have a really hard time finding an article about somebody raving about how, gosh, we can write in Ada. You know, we could write half our program in Ada and half of it in Java. It's not exactly what I call the biggest selling point. And I think that that's going to shake, it's going to shake out that way. And when you look at the survey here, you look at the way people are responding to it, and what you see is people using what they need, building what they need. They don't have anybody selling them on this cool new idea that really doesn't do them very much good, but would do Microsoft a whole lot of good if people would adopt it, because it would help Microsoft lock them into their platform.
Plus, Microsoft tools are so monolithic. I mean, there's these huge constructs. I mean, Visual Studio is a monster.
Yeah.
It does so much. You know, I mean, my last use of it was, you know, some years ago, and it was painful. The API was horrible in the first place, but back then, but it still is, I guess. But the tool set itself was just too big, and it just too much. I didn't need all that. I just needed something to edit my. That's why I switched. That's why I'm using. That's why I'm an Emacs user.
Yeah. The other bit of data that you really need that makes you stand up and take notice, especially if you want to speculate around the future about the future, is that the developers who chose Linux chose it. They listed their top three reasons for choosing Linux. Number one, I told you I was half asleep. Can't remember the actual the order of them. But number two was the fact that Linux is open source. Number one was stability. I'm sorry. Number two is open source, and number three was cost. Now, Microsoft and any proprietary any vendor or proprietary platform, whatever it may be, can achieve stability eventually. But is Microsoft ever going to be able to open source Windows? I mean, I'm talking about open source, not like. Here, I'm going to show you some of the code on this screen for 10 minutes under strict supervision. You know, I'm talking about true open source. And can Microsoft ever match the kind of cost of Linux? So when you've got that kind of appeal, I don't see how anything can compete with those top three selling points for Linux.
How many different software development IDE, in development environments, are there available for Windows, and how many are available for Linux? Does anybody use any? Maybe Borland, but you know, I think that basically it's Visual Studio is it. And again, in Linux, you have a choice of. It's such a rich environment. The Linux environment for a developer is much more richer than the Microsoft developer.
Did you happen to get any comments at all that were Kylix related?
Yeah, it was the number two development environment, Borland Kylix. People like it. It's Borland was rated fairly well for in terms of its open source. There were a couple of anomalies that I thought were kind of odd. That is, one was that the interest in Java was not as great as I thought it would be, and yet there's an awful lot of use of the IDE, the Java IDEs like Eclipse and SunOne, and like I said, the WebSphere platform, and it kind of didn't jibe with the reaction about Java itself. They seem to be using it a lot more than they say they're using it. The other interesting thing that popped out at me too is that here's a big contradiction for you. The number of cracks that people are experiencing in their servers, you know, like people cracking into their servers or whatever, is statistically non-existent. I can't remember the number, but it was like 2 out of all the developers have experienced any kind of a security breach with their Linux systems. Same thing with viruses. You know, nobody's experiencing any viruses, and yet over the past couple of years, their confidence that open source is inherently more secure has been eroding. So it sounds to me like the public relations campaign to try and damage the reputation of open source is actually having some sort of an effect, because the reality of what they're actually experiencing doesn't match their perception.
Oh, I completely agree with that. In fact, that was jives exactly with the story that Russ was talking about earlier tonight. Russ, would you like to comment?
Which story? I'm trying.
The one about email servers.
Oh yeah. Actually, I was thinking when Nick was talking about that there's a talk that I've done quite frequently in the last couple of years about FUD, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and you know, it's kind of interesting that statistically some of the FUD message is apparently working here. But yeah, the stuff that's going on in the virus area is one of those interesting things where you have some people trying to sell the notion that Linux has to be as insecure as Windows, and it has to be because we got this product to sell, and if it ain't as insecure, we ain't going to sell nothing. So it better well damn be pretty insecure.
Yeah.
Plus, there's no virus software, substantial body of virus software available for Linux, and we have all this virus software for our proprietary system. I mean, there's an advantage for us right away, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way I used to put it, on as far as Windows was concerned, is back, you know, there isn't nearly as much software available for the alternative operating systems like OS2 and Linux and stuff than there is for Windows. For example, you don't have those neat little utilities that try to save your data when the system crashes, you know, and all the virus software and the ones that restore your DLLs. I mean, where are all those programs for Linux?
Right.
Well, I mean, all they have to do is get Woody, and they'll be 8,900 some pieces of packages on the Woody install.
Well, Arnie, you got to get started on Dr. Watson for Linux. That's what you got to do.
There you go. Okay, I'll look at it.
It's going to be in an RFP somewhere, I'm sure, along with the antivirus software. Nick, have you gotten any sort of unusual reaction from readers and whatnot from
Well, there's always Slashdot.
Oh, okay.
No, we meant readers.
unexpected unusual reaction, shall we say?
Yeah.
Has anyone looked at your article and said, well, you know, this can't be, or
The only ones that say this can't be are people who didn't actually read the article, because they jumped to all kinds of conclusions about what I was saying. That if you just read the article, you find out that's not what I was saying at all. But other than that, no. I mean, actually, what I've heard the most from anybody is that this has been my experience in the field. You know, that what you're talking about is basically what I experience and just don't see reflected in generally in the media coverage of the way Linux is progressing in the industry. So I think it's confirmed pretty well, at least by the people who've responded.
Okay. Well, very, very interesting. Very interesting.
Now, like I said, during the break, the only interesting kind, you know, it just seems so obvious that someone said, "Well, yeah, gosh, you're saying that more people are moving from Windows to Linux than Unix to Linux." Isn't that just saying that there are more Windows developers to move to Linux than there are Unix developers to move to Linux? I said, well, to an extent, that is self-evident, isn't it? You know, and one has to wonder why in the world anybody bought the suggestion that Linux is stealing more Unix share than Windows share in the first place. You know, I suggested to Evans that I do a survey on gullibility, because that's just not, you know, that just never made sense to me to begin with, so it was kind of an easy myth to dispel, actually.
Okay, well, you know, Nick, I really appreciate you coming out tonight. It's been really great to get some supporting words on the article. I'm going to continue to pull it apart and chew on it and use it as evidence of why... And we need to be focusing more and more on training the students today to be prepared to handle some of that change that's coming down the line. But thank you for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate not only tonight, but the other times you've been on the show. So always appreciated when you come out for us.
Anytime.
Don't be such a stranger, Nick.
Okay.
and keep up the good work.
Yeah, we like
what you do. Great, great, great article.
Thanks very much.
So, one final closing word before we shut down the show tonight. Make sure that you do check out our website, www.thelinuxshow.com. Of course, we do need your ongoing support. Click on the links to our PayPal and send us a few bucks to pay the electrical bill and the phone bill. I want to once again give my thanks out to Stock for his support last month. He basically underwrote our show for the month of March. We really appreciate Stock as one of our Scandinavian listeners. I presume that's appropriate description of him. But thanks again, Stock, for your ongoing support. And make sure you tell 10 friends. Check out The Linux Show. We appreciate all you've done as listeners week after week to make this community grow. And also, sign up for our email list so you can have inside information as the word comes down about GeekPack. In fact, I'm looking at an email right this second from the executive director of one of the largest ISP associations in the world, who is asking me to clarify a couple of things before we release the press releases, but it's coming soon, folks. The first attack of GeekPack. Not the last, but just the first. So get to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, and join the list. But on behalf of the whole team here, Russ and Arnie and Doc and Kevin and myself, we'll see you all next week, same time, same place, The Linux Show. We're out of here, everybody.